Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC coming up in about 15 minutes. The original Harry Potter fans are turning 21. What Harry Potter magic will they take into adulthood? We'll take your calls on that. If you are 20, 21, 22 and started reading Potter as a preteen, or parents of people in that category, coming up in about 15 minutes. But at the Aspen Ideas Festival earlier in the month, one of our guests was brain development expert Patricia Kuhl, talking about brain development and computers. And we had such an interesting follow-up conversation off the air after the show. It is a very conducive atmosphere for conducting ideas there at the Ideas Festival, or for discussing ideas, that we decided to just invite her back and talk some more about things like baby Einstein-type programs, about Dr. Kuhl's search for earlier markers of autism, and about some of the ideas that she has just published in a Science magazine article about the foundations of learning. Patricia Kuhl, K-U-H-L, is co-director of the Institute for Learning and Brain Sciences at the National Science Foundation Science of Learning Center at the University of Washington. Dr. Kuhl, welcome back to WNYC. Hello.
Well, hello, Brian.
So at the simplest level, as we were discussing in Aspen, parents and grandparents all over our audience are spending millions of dollars on baby Einstein and other programs to make their kids smarter sooner. Do you poo-poo the whole field?
Well, no, I don't think we're ready to poo-poo the whole field. But what we have seen in the laboratory is that if you value second language instruction and you'd like to have your child learn a second language, our evidence says it doesn't do any good to put them in front of a television screen in which you are listening to the language or listening to an audio tape that presents French or Tagalog or Mandarin. The child won't learn it. Our studies show that the babies are inherently social, that if you put them face-to-face with the speaker of a foreign language like Mandarin or French, they will absorb the information like a sponge, but that same information, and this is in babyhood at 9 months of age, that same information presented over a beautiful TV screen or a clear audio tape creates no learning in their little brains.
And parents, if you want to call and explore the nuances of that question and whether you should be doing what you're doing to develop your child's smarts, we can take a few phone calls for Patricia Kuhl at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And even beyond that, you write in your Science magazine article that developmental immaturity has value. Is it even desirable to speed up brain development in the sense that some people try to do it?
I think we shouldn't try to speed up brain development. I think what we should do is understand brain development and capitalize on the baby's exquisite sensitivity to other people and to the things that people do. So whether it's them talking, you know, the sounds coming out of those mouths, or whether it is the actions that we take on avidly, the kids just pick up what we do. They pick up the language and they pick up our social actions and values. So understanding these critical windows, these periods of development where babies become interested in various things that we're doing and take action, watch us and then duplicate, imitate those actions, that's what we need to do.
Now, in the science article, you also wrote about the foundations for a new science of learning. That was the title. Mm-hmm. And you talk about how studying the plasticity of the human brain and computational approaches to learning are laying a new foundation for understanding how people learn. So what do you mean by plasticity of the brain?
So early in development, the baby has an opportunity to learn by watching, doing, and listening. And we talk about the brain's ability to forge connections because that's, in fact, physiologically what's going on. You're born with trillions of neurons, virtually all the neurons you're ever going to have. But what grows in development is connections between them. And between one and about five, these connections grow exuberantly. You develop trillions, hundreds of trillions of connections between cells so they can talk to one another. So that plasticity, that immaturity, allows the child to focus and build these structures, this architecture of the brain, in a unique way given their experience. And the interesting thing is that from this early developmental period where they have three times the number of connections that we do, three times the number of synapses, those synapses will be pruned up until the end of puberty to carve out a brain that's uniquely theirs. So we're all walking around with brains whose real estate is committed to various things, depending upon what we did with our lives.
And are there any implications of that understanding for what we should do?
Well, I think we should take seriously what we put in front of children. We should understand how their brains work, that they're socially motivated, that communication and trust is one of the foundations of learning, that there are times in development where they're particularly interested in certain kinds of things. So early in the first 5 years, language and social functioning, the development of the interactions between people and communication between people. And then as they head to school, we need to capitalize more on their drive to communicate with one another socially. And that involves technology. So rather than being against technology, what I'm saying is that technology that makes it more like you're interacting with a human, so social technologies, technologies that capitalize on interaction and collaboration, that could be a good thing. We're all for technology that teaches.
Ray in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
I love your program.
Thank you.
Just a quick question. My son's 19 months old, and he listened. I mean, I've tried showing him the Your Baby Can Read program.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to see how effective you feel that is.
Well, I think that, you know, I can't comment on specific technologies that I haven't tested. We're doing pretty natural experiments where we either allow babies to experience something live from another human being or something that's, you know, pre-programmed on a video or audio tape.
Ray, what does that one do, just so people know what you're talking
sure.
about?
Your Baby Can Read is a program where it's a visual where, you know, it's... they have people saying, for example, Lainey, wave, and, like, you know, they'll show a little baby waving, basically. Or, you know, put your hands up, and, like, you know, like the baby will put their hands up. And basically, the child or a toddler would basically watch it and kind of grasp that and try to, you know, imitate them. That's the whole
right.
idea of it. And, you know, so far results show, I mean, that's what people have been talking about, that it's supposed to be very effective.
Dr. Cole?
Well, I think that the evidence shows that babies will imitate. You know, it's a nonverbal way of communication, a nonverbal way of getting the culture's actions into the baby's head is to do them and watch the baby imitate. So imitation is there early, and there's the suggestion that you can at least... we've seen studies where 18-monthers are imitating what it is that a person is doing. So it may be effective on a television set to do imitative actions, at least beyond the age of one. I'm not recommending it for under one, but as you approach the age of two, I think imitation games are interesting and kids will probably follow them. Exactly what that does to future development, I think parents should be wary of anything they're doing that, you know, attempts to get the child into Harvard. That you're not going to do something with a program that you can't do better face-to-face.
Robert in Milburn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Robert.
Yeah, hi. Pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
My son and his wife have twins, fraternal twins, a boy and a girl. My daughter-in-law is Chinese. My son is Caucasian. The children are being raised with both languages, and I'm actually amazed to watch the way they switch between languages.
Right.
In the middle of a sentence or sometimes, I've actually seen.
Yes, exactly.
Does it make the brain develop in different ways, Dr. Cole?
It does. All of the evidence so far in adults and in school-aged children, and we're now developing the evidence for babies, that exposure to two languages has one cognitive advantage. Now, I'm not saying it makes the children smarter, but what I am saying is that it gives them one talent, and that is cognitive flexibility. We are always switching attention when we're operating in the world, and multitasking is something that's really pushed our abilities to switch attention to the limit. But kids and adults who have been exposed to two languages get into the habit of recognizing that, you know, whenever you're in a situation, you have to decide which of the languages tucked in your little brain you're going to be using. And so that cognitive switching and realizing that everything in the world has two different names seems to have an advantage outside the domain of language, meaning that in other tasks, in problem-solving tasks, even little kids who have been exposed to two languages are faster and more accurate at inventing a new solution.
That is so interesting. So maybe instead of computer programs for your toddlers, you should get somebody who speaks another language from you and try to make your baby a little bilingual.
Exactly. It's a very interesting phenomenon that this kind of attentional switching in language could have advantages beyond language.
Okay. Reason to hang around in diverse crowds. Now, and my guest is Patricia Kuhl, brain development expert from the University of Washington. You told me at Aspen that some of your work is looking for earlier markers of autism than we have now. How is autism diagnosed currently, and how early can that take place?
Well, autism is a pretty devastating disorder, not only for the child, but for the parents who are trying to interact with the child. As I'm sure most of the listeners know, it's a disorder that's characterized by a lack of language and by a lack of social skills. And it's diagnosed later than we'd like it to be now. It's diagnosed typically at the end of the second year or beginning of the third or fourth year, and it's usually picked up as a lack of social skills where children do not want to look at the face, they do not want to look at or listen to the voice of their parents or other people. They'd rather look at objects, play with objects, even listen to objects. So we've been looking at language development from birth on, and we're very interested in being able to diagnose earlier children who are at high risk for autism. And that, why do we want to do that? Because the brain is so plastic. We know that we can invent techniques for dealing with children, but the younger the better, because their brains are still forging their synaptic connections and carving out the architecture. So one of the phenomena that we have been studying is something that we call mother-ease or parent-ease, caretaker-ease. It's the way we talk to babies and children as opposed to adults. You can hear it immediately when you're listening to a parent who's talking to you in a normal tone of voice like I am right now, and then turns to the baby they're holding and says, "Hello, let's open those big blue eyes. Let me see them." That sort of thing. It's not your job interview voice, right? It's the voice you use automatically, implicitly, when you're in front of kids. And, you know, parents, people who've never had children, grandparents, and even children with younger siblings use this tone of voice. And we've determined in the laboratory that kids, babies, prefer it when given a choice over adult-directed speech and over non-speech, you know, analogs, we call them, sounds that match speech but don't sound like speech. So we've been doing these choice tests where all the children have to do is look in one direction. A slight glance to the right or left will turn on either mother-ease or a matched non-speech signal that has all the same tones but doesn't sound like speech. Sounds like a computer warble. And we notice that typical kids will love to listen to speech, and they will listen a bit at the non-speech analog, but they don't prefer it. Children with autism prefer it hands down. They select it over and over and over again to listen to this computer-like warble. And we can do this test as early as 15 weeks. So we're now in progress on a diagnostic marker experiment in which we're testing the siblings of children with autism. We know that the rate of occurrence is much higher. So we're trying to predict. If this turns out to predict which children will get autism, it will be a very, very interesting and important finding.
A boon to earlier intervention. And before you go, is there also a lesson there for how parents interact with their autistic children? I mean, it's heartbreaking to think that they prefer to listen to a machine than their own parents. But is there something there that they can apply using the machine to help keep a connection?
Well, we're also interested in that. It's possible that because children with autism prefer a more monotone voice and prefer non-faces, that we may eventually develop interventions that have to do with using machines to get children with autism's interest in language and map that language well during the critical period for development. So those experiments are still on the drawing board, but it could be interesting at some point to give parents an intervention that they could use.
Dr. Patricia Kuhl, K-U-H-L, co-director of the Institute for Learning and Brain Sciences at the National Science Foundation Science of Learning Center at the University of Washington. She also has an article in the current issue of the journal Science called Foundations for a New Science of Learning. Fascinating to talk to you again. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks, Brian. It was fun.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next, the original Harry Potter fans, who were maybe preteens at the time, turned 21. What magic will you take into adulthood as a result of all that exposure to Hogwarts? 212-433-WNYC. Call us up, 212-433-9692.